afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Elodie Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. My co-host, Alfred Adusk, and James Corbett of The Corbett Report will be here after the first segment of today's program. It is that Thursday, October 12th, 2017. They'll be joining you, and it looks like it's going to be a great program today, as I think it is every day. So let's get started with the first segment anyway today. Going to do the market report, and we had gold stronger. We're looking at $1,294 for gold, $1,294 for gold, up $2. We have silver up 7 cents today at $17.32. Platinum was up $7 at $943. Palladium up 12 at $974. The USDX today was higher also, 0.12 at 93.10, but there was pressure on oil, down 0.67 at 50.63. The paper markets today, the Dow was down 31 points at 22,841. The NASDAQ was down 12 at 6,591. The S&P was down 4 at 2,550. The 10-year yield, 2.32%, down 0.02. And, of course, the euro was a little bit weaker, down 0.24 at 118. Dollar was weaker earlier in the day, but it did turn around here late in the day. And there's just, you know, there's just so much going on. It's hard to keep up with all and making sure that it's the real news and not fake news. There's a lot of things going on. So I just tried to pull some things that I thought were, you know, were interesting. And the one thing I do want to comment on today is those fires in California. And just terrible. They're just they're having 45 mile an hour winds. It's raining ash. It's the pollution is equal to years of traffic. There's 26 plus dead. I mean, some of these people didn't even know it was coming to their, you know, it just cropped up. One woman woke up and 20 minutes later her house was burned down. They were able to escape. So just some terrible and frightening stories that you hear. And so our thoughts and prayers are those for those in California. But those wildfires continue to spread. There was a small quake detected in North Korea. Is that another nuke test? Well, I guess we'll just have to wait and see if we get any confirmation. It's not big headlines, but it occurred in the same area of the previous North Korean nuclear tests. The event has similar earthquake-like characteristics. And this is from the USGS website. They can't confirm it, so I'll have to wait and see. So it's similar to what they had before, and they have been awfully quiet. So 1-800-375-4188 for all your gold and silver coin needs. I'm going to continue with the special backed by popular demand. Mint State 62, $10 Liberty gold pieces, $695. They're a steal at that price, $695. If you purchase two, we'll include the shipping costs for you. Two or more shipping is included for $10 Liberties in Mint State 62. We'll try to miss, you know, get you as many different dates as possible. Sometimes it's difficult, you know, in these lower grades and in the uncirculated grades. If you buy them circulated, usually you get a wide range of various dates. But once you get into the uncirculated area of these coins, and remember, folks, it brings you privacy, performance, and profit. So a good reason to be purchasing these 62 Mint State 62 $10 Liberty gold pieces at $695. Today, President Trump, he continued trying to chip away from the Obamacare. He signed an executive order today. I'm not sure what it exactly does, but he had the blessings of Rand Paul, I believe. Rand Paul has worked on this executive order with White House officials and dubbed it the biggest free market change to the healthcare system in many years. but it merely directs agencies to craft new rules that one senior official would only say could possibly help millions of Americans despite the promises. This was called a historic announcement, promised it would come at zero cost to the federal coffers. During a signing ceremony at the White House, Mr. Trump also promised it would bring more affordable coverage to millions and said plans would be available all across state lines, with competition among providers that he promised will be staggering. Once and for all, we will have great health care in our country, he said of the order, and his expectation that Republican lawmakers will eventually pass a bill repealing and replacing the 2010 law. The order, however, does not contain language that would make those things happen quickly or perhaps even at all. But we have an executive order. It's an attempt. You got to give the guy credit for that. It directs the three federal agencies. You have the, maybe I don't have that available. It has the Health and Human Services, Labor, and Treasury. So it is those three federal agencies that are supposed to craft the rules at making more individuals eligible for insurance plans. And we'll have to see how it unfolds, if it actually, because of something, if it becomes of something of value. And we'll just have to wait and see. Mr. Trump was in Pennsylvania, I believe it was just yesterday, touting the tax reform. And you know what? I just don't agree with, you know, some of it, yes. All of it, no. And, you know, you can have terrific tax cuts, but, I mean, look at Reagan. He had some terrific tax cuts, but he had to raise taxes 11 times over the course of his presidency. And so you can get one good year maybe from these tax cuts. Maybe you'll get a bump in the economy for 1 or 2 years. But then again, it doesn't work. We're too far in debt. The size of national debt when Reagan took office was $1 trillion. After 6 years, it was 2.3. Certainly nothing like Obama, but that was a 130% increase. At the end of his presidency, it had gone to $2.9 trillion. That's a 190% increase. Folks, I think people who think that these tax cuts are going to be great and it's going to solve all of our problems, I don't think they understand the debt that this country has to absorb. And again, we might get temporary benefits, but everything is so distorted. Everything is based on, I mean, heck, they even had, there's more reality back when Reagan was in office than there is today. And so it's a big difference, you know, then versus today. And of course, the death tax, I mean, I've been reading up on that. And it's not quite that everybody loses their home and their farms. At one time they did, back in the early 2000s, I think the cap at that point in time was $675,000. That's when tax would begin affecting the assets. That did affect a lot of people. People did lose their farms. But now it's $6 million. Plus you get, you know, other benefits and so forth. And it doesn't quite affect as many as at one time that it did. And the Economic Growth and Tax Relief Reconciliation Act, we'll talk about this another day because I always run out of time and I never get the numbers right when I'm trying to hurry along. But I have it broken down, and maybe I'll put this in our weekly newsletter. But it shows the data from what I was gathering up and hoping to bring to you today back in 2002. It was $1 million people would be affected. Then it went to $3.5 million through 2009. And then they increased it up to over $5 million. And, you know, they just keep rising it. And so less and less people are affected by it. And The Tax Policy Center estimates there will be only about 11,300 estate tax returns filed, of which 5,500 will be taxable. Estate tax liability will total $20 billion after credits. So to put that number of estate returns in perspective, the population division of the Bureau of the Census projects that 2.7 million people will die this year. Thus, an estate tax return will be filed for only 1 in 237 people, and 1 in 487 will pay any estate tax. And there's various ways. So it's there's a lot of, you know, misrepresenting of that. And that's the part that disturbs me. And I don't think that it should be. Already the investors are going to Texas. Wall Street's going to Texas. Soon they'll be going to Puerto Rico. I mentioned a couple times, you know, if you want some good real estate, go to Puerto Rico. You can get it fairly cheap. And these people are now doing the same for the Houston area. Brian Child drives through Houston looking for the opportunity of a lifetime and an investment opportunity of a lifetime. Homes are selling for as little as 40 cents on the dollar. We pay cash for flooded homes. Don't fix it, sell it. Quick close, reads the signs piled up in the back of his Ford pickup. He stops by a ranch-style home, and the owner's 74 years old. His wife is disabled. He's desperate. These people are desperate to leave, and they're actually considering his offer of $120,000, half of the home's value. 3 weeks earlier, a half a dozen other investors have made offers, one as low as $55,000. And this gentleman, a 74-year-old, says the whole thing makes me feel like there's a bunch of vultures sitting on my back fence. They're waiting for the dead body to fall over. And we know Wall Street did it after the 2008 collapse in the real estate market. They went in there and they bought up the homes from the banks. And they turned them into rentals. They, you know, put them in pension plans, pension funds, pension plans. And in fact, I had one real estate agent, and in fact, he was from Las Vegas, told me he thought that would be what brought the financial system down. He says, because not only did you have the banks that are still carrying those toxic assets, but you have a bunch of these hedge funds going in there buying up these homes who have no idea how to run and manage rental homes. And there are times when you have bad rents, you don't get paid. There's a lot of, you can have a lot of destruction, damages to these homes that have to be repaired, replaced, and the cost of having them managed. He really did think that this would be the area that would bring the banking system down. And we're still not quite sure what will bring the banking system down, but debt. But so they're in there. Blackstone Group, other marquee names have bought foreclosed homes after these floods. And here's another one, Bain Capital. Mark Benioff, he's co-founder of Salesforce. They're trying to get into these areas and just buy these homes, pennies, just pennies on the dollar. So think of it as what you might. The IMF, not a lot of talk about this, is in Washington. The IMF and the World Bank is in Washington this week for the annual meeting. They seem to think there's some monumental challenges facing these global finance ministers and the central bankers. The fall meeting comes as policymakers warn of risks that could derail the recovery and hinder global economic growth, including trade protectionism, policy uncertainty, and potential turbulence in the financial markets. Those that basically that they're including is, of course, North Korea. They are looking to Venezuela. Their economy is spiraling out of control. They're looking, they're estimating Venezuela's inflation will be about 2,300% in 2018. And they're also looking at hoping that we get the tax cuts here in the States. And so they're not really quite sure how the global economy is going to work this year. And certainly their biggest concern is probably the protectionism. And hopefully Mr. Trump, they said he might not approve. We're the major shareholder in the group. And it was actual comments that he would not go along with their new budget. And so good for him. And that's when I like Mr. Trump, when he stands up to these people and say, you know, cut the spending. We're not going to do this. We're not going to do that. That's when I like Mr. Trump. Not when he's going around with the tax cuts that is really, folks, truly for the wealthy. People say, what's wrong with that? They'll bring jobs back. And, well, they might bring some jobs back, but do you really believe that wages will go up? There's a lot of factors that affect wages. And we're going to talk about them someday. It's the globalization, and it's just not because our factories left this country. There's a lot of factors. Came across this one article. I just have a few seconds. This is short. It's disturbing. I don't know if any of you know Dan Brown. He writes books. His series of books of Inferno, where I can't think of his name, was actually in the movie. And he's coming out with some bar. He says, humanity no longer needs God. My view, humanity needs God more than ever. But he thinks with the help of artificial intelligence, they will develop a new form of collective consciousness that fulfills the role of religion. I mean, this guy is nutty. But, you know, there's a lot of people that believe that. We certainly can see it, that we're heading more and more towards a godless nation. And we keep saying we can't turn things around until we do bring God back into this country. 1-800-375-4188. So, you know, he already has godzillions of dollars of money, so boycotting his books and his movies won't hurt him that much, but spread the word. The guy's a lunatic. 800-375-4188. We'll be right back with Alfred and James Corbett. Thank you for joining us.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it: to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cedarstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cedarstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. TimUpRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Alfred Addisk, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188 for all your gold and silver coin needs. Our guest is James Corbett from the Corbett Report. James is calling in from Japan. He has he was engaged in a speaking engagement in Copenhagen back now about a month ago. And we talked a little about that last week, but my point is that James is building a name for himself on a global basis. And one of the best sources for intelligent commentary on the internet and in the world. And here's one of the... Hello, James. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for having me on.
Yep. Always a pleasure. I've got a little oddball piece here from... What's this from? Free Thought Project. And the headline is, entire volume of CIA files on Lee Harvey Oswald, set to be released in October, has gone missing. Now, this was actually published on September 18th. I don't know if this is something you're aware of or not. Do you have any comments on this? We're going to release the files on Lee Harvey Oswald this month. And now
yes.
It turns out, my gosh, they're missing.
Who would have thought it? Yes, I did see this this article when it came out back in last month, and I think it's an unfortunately kind of clickbaity headline because it makes it sound like this volume of files on Oswald just went missing. That's not quite the case. When you read through the story, this is volume five? Of the seven volumes that the CIA had submitted to the ARRB in 1998, the Assassination Records Review Board that was set up in the wake of Oliver Stone's JFK film to review and declassify the JFK records. It seems that Volume 5 is missing and has been for some time. So this isn't exactly a breaking news story, but it is an important story, and it is about the question about what is the CIA telling us and not telling us about what it knew and what it did and how it worked with Lee Harvey Oswald. Exceptionally important. And I did talk about the idea of this declassification that's supposed to take place later this month regarding the JFK files. As people may or may not know, they were sealed up for another 25 years ago. And so, lo and behold, we're at that moment where the rest of the files are supposed to be declassified. There's still, of course, loopholes for national security and things like that. But at any rate, there's supposed to be thousands of documents that are set to be released. And in fact, there were a few thousand that were released in July ahead of that deadline. So this is a year of potential discovery of JFK. But as I talked about in the video that I made about this, I think about a month ago, I noted that it seems like they're already starting to seed a narrative into the press surrounding this release of document. And that narrative is something along the lines of basically the Warren Commission was worried about pointing the finger in a way that would bring in the Soviets and point to the Soviet potential role in all of this, because it was those Ruskies that may or may not have had a hand, and the CIA might have wanted to cover that up to prevent a world war or something along those lines, which I assume your listeners will know is a lot of hogwash. But I think that's the way this is going to be spun, and I personally am not holding my breath waiting for some magic document, you know, some Alan Dulles orders to kill Kennedy, you know, signed and on the dotted line coming out as a result of this release of documents. Of course, I don't think they're going to get us to the real bottom of the JFK assassination. There can be, and sometimes are, some interesting revelations that come out in these documents. For example, one of the documents unearthed by that Assassination Records Review Board back in the 1990s was the Operation Northwoods documents, the plan that was signed off on by the Joint Chiefs of Staff, sitting there on Kennedy's desk waiting to be signed, which, thankfully, he did not. But that plan was, as people may know, to attack, to stage attacks, to send up drone planes and then shoot them down and claim it was the Cubans shooting down a passenger jet, starting terrorist attacks in Washington. There were a number of things that were talked about in that document as a way to start a false flag provocation to justify invading Cuba. And as I say, that document, the Operation Northwoods document, we only know about that because of the Assassination Records Review Board. So it's, I'm not poo-pooing the idea that there could be interesting nuggets coming out on October 26th with this release of documents. But I'm just saying I don't think this is going to get us to the bottom of the Kennedy assassination.
Do you anticipate taking a closer look at any of these documents yourself? Or are you going to just kind of let nature and history take its course and set it off to the side and...
Well, I'll certainly be interested in them. I will definitely be interested in them, but I'm not an expert by any means. I mean, there are people out there who have been spending literally the vast majority of their lives at this point, 50 years researching this, and I'm not one of those people. I haven't read every book that's ever been written on it. So I'll be looking at them myself for sure, but I think I'll be relying on people who have been researching it to see if there are any golden nuggets in there. And I'll certainly let people know if there is anything really game-changing that comes out.
I can remember when the Kennedy assassination took place. I was at the University of Illinois for my first semester of my freshman year, and it was a strange situation, but I was not obsessed with it. But I understood from the beginning there was something wrong, because they said we were sealing the records, and the excuse was out of respect for the Kennedy family. And I thought to myself, I don't care about the Kennedy family. Somebody has murdered the president of the United States, and they're saying this is special, or the Kennedys are special, and we don't need to see the records, don't need to be released to the public. And I knew from the moment that was brought out that this is just irrational. I mean, we're doing this to protect the Kennedys.
That's an even more blatant and disgusting lie when you find out that Robert F. Kennedy knew that what they'd done to his brother, and said that I know that it wasn't Oswald acting alone, but I can't prove anything till I'm the president, and we all know how that ended up. So
yeah, I understand that. What did Bobby know, or Teddy know?
Good question. And was that scuttled forever at Chappaquiddick and all of that stuff? And then JFK Jr. also suffering an interesting fate, which of course was just an accident, right? Until you start looking at the events of that day. And there was an excellent documentary a few years ago about the JFK Jr. crash, and I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head, but it went into the how that actually unfolded, and the fact that rescuers were kept away from the scene seemingly deliberately for hours while certain government agencies were swooping in there before the Coast Guard and others could respond. There was more going on with that crash than might have seemed at first glance. And interesting when you find that JFK Jr., of course, had even floated the idea of tackling the assassination in his recently launched magazine that he had just launched a couple of years. Yes, exactly.
Yeah. It turns out the Kennedy family seemed to be so glamorous. You wouldn't remember this firsthand because I don't think you were born at the time.
Certainly not.
At the time that John F. Kennedy was in the White House, the Kennedy family seemed glamorous and exciting and vital and the rest of it. And yet, this whole thing has turned out to be something of a disaster, a curse on the Kennedy family. Joe, oldest brother, he died in World War II. His father pushed John to be president, and then Bobby pushed to be president, and Ted never bothered to be president. He just seemed to be content to be drunk and chase wild women. But I wonder if the Kennedy family right now, do they see themselves as something special or something cursed? Do you have any idea?
I don't know the inner workings of the Kennedy family. I would imagine at this point, I mean, it's the political legacy is there, but I don't imagine that they are chomping at the bit to try to take over, you know, and become a political dynasty in the same way as they were back half a century ago. So I think that's probably been pummeled out of them at this point. I think there's also a danger for, which I understand, but for people to venerate and put on a pedestal JFK because of what ultimately ended up happening to him. And I think there is something to the fact that JFK was instrumental in stopping the craziest elements of the Pentagon from being as crazy as they could be. Not only the things like Operation Northwoods, but ultimately World War III with Russia and the nuclear conflagration, which so easily could have eventuated. So there is something to that, but I think we have to keep in mind the Kennedy family generally, the bootlegger fortune that they made, and very questionable ways in which JFK got into power in the first place, clearly stole the 1960 election from Nixon. And I think, again, there's the tendency to put them on a pedestal and venerate them. I think that's a not only incorrect, but also slightly dangerous, because it leads to false interpretations of history, like the idea that's been kicked around heavily in the last few decades that JFK was going to end the Federal Reserve, and he had signed Executive Order 11110 and all of this, which when you actually look into the history of that, you find it is the exact opposite. It is exactly opposite as most quote-unquote researchers like to portray it. When you actually read the executive order and the other things that he was writing in 1963, Kennedy was purposefully trying to demonetize silver to get it out as a monetary unit, precisely because it was a valuable metal and we don't want to change its price based on its monetary use. And so he was handing over the powers to do exactly what ended up happening, to stop printing those silver certificates. Yes, a silver certificate was issued, I believe, in 63, but that was the last one, and it was precisely because JFK was purposefully handing over the powers to the Secretary of the Treasury to stop doing that. And that's why he did it. He was taking powers that was within the office of the president and giving them to the Secretary of the Treasury so that they could wind down that program and stop printing silver certificates. It's not at all that he was challenging the Fed. In fact, he was trying to strengthen it.
Now, that surprises me, because what I had heard and understood for most of my life is that, or at least thought I understood, was that Kennedy was proposing, it may be that they were against silver certificates, but he was going to print greenbacks, meaning currency that was issued by the government rather than the Federal Reserve, out into the nation, and the advantage would be that the currency would be available, but there wouldn't be any interest on it. And some people believe that was the reason, as I understand it, that he was assassinated. And supposedly, Lyndon Johnson, first thing he did was cancel the executive order that said we're going to start printing these greenbacks. And Johnson said we're not going back to that. But some people think that was the real reason he was assassinated, had to do with the money. What do you think about that?
I 100% believe that not to be the case, and I've laid this out. I did an interview with G. Edward Griffin several months ago at this point. That's up on my website, so people can just search for G. Edward Griffin, and we talked about this in detail with links to the documents, including his 1963 economic address, where he talked about getting rid of the silver certificates and how he wanted to strengthen the Federal Reserve and actually gave them the power to start issuing $1 Federal Reserve notes, which they did not have before that. So he was absolutely strengthening the Federal Reserve. It's 180 degrees to what's been propounded. And as far as I know, that can trace back to Jim Marr's 1988, I want to say, book, Crossfire, which is a great book on the Kennedy assassination. Tons of great information, but he spends about 2 pages talking about this executive order that supposedly was going to end the Fed. And I'm afraid I just don't think Jim Marr really did his homework on that one. And that kind of spread, that idea spread. So now that people have heard this idea, they've heard, oh, he was fighting the Fed, he was going to end it somehow, but very few people have actually looked at the documents that this supposedly comes from.
So if you had to guess, can you point to what may be a reason for his assassination?
I would say with any deep state operation of that magnitude, it's never a single issue. I think it's a confluence of a lot of different people who have different agendas that that all converge at a certain point, and they converged at the killing of Kennedy. Clearly, it was a deep state event, and I think there were different people involved in that for different reasons. I think there probably was mob elements and things like that involved, as people have talked about for a long time. But perhaps more importantly, I think Alan Dulles and his firing and Kennedy talking about splintering the CIA into 1,000 pieces and probably had something to do with it. Obviously what was going on in Vietnam and the proposed wind down and drawdown of troops there, as opposed to obviously what Johnson ended up doing, and Kennedy's reluctance to give Israel the bomb, basically, which is ultimately pretty much what ended up happening. They kind of stole it from the U.S., but at any rate, the nuclear technology transfer that was going on at that time, JFK was opposed to. I think these types of issues, again, there's lots of different people swirling around for different reasons that all converge at that point of, we have to get rid of this guy.
I think it's interesting. You talk about a confluence of forces that agree that he's got to go. When we see, how does that compare with Mr. Trump? Are there? I'm trying to think how many forces think he has to stay. There's plenty of people who think he has to go. What do you think the probability is that Mr. Trump is going to survive the first 4 years of his administration?
Well, I suppose it depends on to what extent does he present a real roadblock to any particular plan. And I would be interested to hear what exactly he is acting as a roadblock to on the greater scheme of things, in terms of not what he said on the campaign trail, but what he is actually doing. What we're getting is not Obamacare repealed, but basically Obamacare baked into the cake. What we're getting is not the end of wars and some sort of peace president. We're getting a president who's now about to scrap the Iran nuclear deal and potentially start World War III in the Middle East. What we're getting is not some nationalist to America first who's going to withdraw, you know, the billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars of aid to Israel, but someone who's actually wants to increase that and wants to strengthen that relationship. So everything that was said on the campaign trail, of course, played well to a populist base, but I haven't seen anything that actually follows through on that, which is precisely why Trump is, this week, meeting once again with Henry Kissinger. I think he's very much tied into that establishment, which he pretended to be against. So I don't see him fundamentally as presenting a threat, a fundamental threat to the power structure. There are clearly people within that power structure who don't like Trump and aren't working with him, but I think there are people in that power structure who just see him as another useful vessel. And until that relationship ends, I'm not sure he's really in danger. I think the only question would be, would the deep state find perhaps more utility in causing chaos by assassinating the president? I think that might be a calculation here.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more about President Trump when we return on Financial Survival in just a moment. I'll be back with James Corbett. Please stay tuned.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com, or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light Systems today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Alfred Addisk. I'm here with James Corbett from the Corbett Report. And we've been talking about politics in general, assassinations, President Trump. One of the things that strikes me is that if you're going to be president, I think you've got to have a gang. You've got to have some sort of core group of supporters that surround you, all right, and protect you. I get that impression. And there's got to be, you know, the Bush gang, the Clinton gang, the Obama gang. I don't think Trump has a gang, does he?
I think he does. I think that we see that obviously with Kushner and the connections that he brings to the table.
That's family. I mean, I understand what you're saying, but
yeah. So it is different than the way the Bush clan or the Clinton clan function, but I think it's the same idea. And the connections ultimately start reaching out into the deep state. I think that's a good way to look at it, though. There are gangs and cliques, and then there are gophers who are content to work between those different gangs. Mm-hmm. And again, I think there is some genuine rivalry that goes on. And I think the Clintons probably really don't like the Trump family at this point. But at any rate, whatever
you
that
mean,
amounts
Hillary
to,
carries a grudge.
Who would?
She doesn't seem like the kind of woman to carry a grudge.
Yeah, time to move on, right?
I guess so. Here's another comment. Here's something. What is this from Cointelegraph? And the headline is Bitcoin frightens governments. This is a headline, and the source of the comment is John McAfee. Do you think Bitcoin is cryptocurrencies in general and Bitcoin in particular? Do you think they really frighten governments?
Well, I am going to refer your listeners to an editorial I wrote for the International Forecaster a couple of weeks ago called "The Bitcoin PSYOP." And
yeah, I have it here in front of me.
And
but
in
go
that
ahead.
Article, I talked about the basically the ways that people throw around, because this is a new concept. It's a new thing that's happening. We tend to dismiss, oh, there's nothing new under the sun. I think there really is something new with the underlying technology on which Bitcoin is based, and many other things as well, called blockchain ledger. It's a decentralized open ledger that there is no central point of control. That is something that truly hasn't existed before in human history, and we're just starting to discover different ways that it can be used. Bitcoin is one protocol that happens to use the blockchain ledger to enable what it does. And so people are trying to get their heads wrapped around this, and so they throw out Bitcoin and blockchain and cryptocurrency and digital currency and all of these different terms as if they are all just one thing. But they are not. And I think that's part of the problem here. So is there a potential for cryptocurrency properly done, with the right protocol to be a genuine threat to the banking system and to the establishment and to governments around the world? Absolutely there is. Does Bitcoin necessarily represent that threat? It depends. There is kind of a battle for the soul of Bitcoin that's going on within even the Bitcoin community at this point, and to what extent do they want to start complying with all the various regulations and jumping through all the hoops in order to become a legitimate currency so that they can be safe from the authorities, by which, of course, we mean just playing into the authorities and whatever they say. And then there's the other question of all the other cryptocurrencies that have been created, and then there's even the possibility of central bank cryptocurrencies, literally central banks creating their own quote-unquote cryptocurrencies that will be, I think, crypto in name only, that the Bank for International Settlements was writing a white paper on recently. So there's a lot of different concepts going around here. The basic question, can cryptocurrency pose a threat to the central bank paradigm, the banking establishment, governments around the world? Absolutely, yes. Is it going to pose that threat? That remains to be seen, and it remains that remains ultimately in the hands of the users of these different currencies and what they want to accomplish with them. If they just want some sort of investment tool that they jump through all the regulatory compliance hoops and in order to have a legitimate business, then it's not going to pose that much of a threat. There will be regulations imposed upon it, and if people try to use it for the kind of pirate money that it was originally intended to be, then it could pose a threat.
Well, it raises a question, a big question. What exactly is money? And I don't think it's not just, you can't just say here's a piece of paper, this is money, or here's a disc, a metallic disc, and this is money, or here are digital entries in a decentralized ledger, and that's money. There is a question of what is money, and it's not just an intellectual argument. For example, here's something from the Foundation for Economic Education, and the headline is, India's demonetization effort has demonstrably failed. And they're talking about India's attempt to get rid of cash. All right, they wanted to take it out of their economy, and it's kind of blown up in their face. And the implication is that there's something about money that is not simply a function of the elite. They tell us, this is money, it's a pink piece of paper, use it, okay? Maybe the public doesn't accept that. Here's money, it's a piece of plastic, use that. There's a point in time where if the public doesn't agree that something is money, then it's not. And maybe the system doesn't function without what the public wants. In India, they want their paper, they want their rubies, 500 ruby dollar or 500 ruby note and 1,000 ruby note and so on. Can something like Bitcoin can attract people, but can the government compel us to use something like a Federal Reserve Bitcoin?
Can they compel people to do that? Yes, I think we've seen that. I mean, that's how the fiat currency system survives today. There is the legal tender laws that mean that they collect the taxes in that fiat currency, and all debts are payable with that kind of fiat currency. So it becomes the default that everyone uses in 99% of their transactions 99% of the time. So they can compel people into a system or other. But the more fundamental question of what is money, I think that genuinely is a question that I think more people need to ponder, because a lot of people have just become entrenched in their ideas of that. And you'll have the gold bugs out there who are insisting that, well, money has these criteria and only, you know, precious metals can possibly attain them, and that's why we need just precious metals. And then you have other people with various other interpretations of this question. I think this is a question that's more philosophical than that, because I think fundamentally, as an abstraction, the idea of money is a type of language that we use to communicate value to each other. And that can be done in a lot of different ways, in a lot of different contexts, using a lot of different things. And the question of cryptocurrency is that it really blows open that paradigm in a fundamentally new way. And I've recently been listening to the audiobook version of a book that was penned by Andreas Antonopoulos. He's one of the kind of Bitcoin philosophers, I guess, of the last several years. And he wrote a book called The Internet of Money, where he's talking about what Bitcoin is and what it means and how it's changing our paradigms. And what he makes a very interesting point that people look at the crypto coins and they say, oh, well, look, it's not just Bitcoin. Now there's Ethereum and Dash and Monero and all of these other different cryptocurrencies. It's ridiculous. I mean, how can they all have value? How can they all survive? This doesn't make sense. You know, clearly it has to be one or none. I mean, you can't have all these different currencies. And he makes the point, well, saying how many cryptocurrencies should there be is like saying how many websites should there be? One, two, ten? can you have millions and billions of websites that all exist simultaneously and all have different value for different people in different situations? Well, obviously, yes, you can. And he's making the point that that's what is happening in the cryptocurrency space, to the point where eventually the trend is towards everyone will have and will issue their own currency, which sounds insane. It sounds absolutely...
15 minutes of fame? You get 15 minutes of fame totally... and 15 minutes of your own currency.
It sounds totally nonsensical until you start to think of the ways that currencies are being used and the things that can be enabled by the idea of being able to create a currency as a type of, not necessarily an exchange that is used to facilitate an economic transaction even, although obviously can be used for that, but as an exchange of value in some sense or other, that coins can be created around internet memes that people then actually adopt and use as currency, which is actually what Dogecoin is. It's this coin, which its emblem is this Shiba dog. It was this internet meme that became this coin that was issued and is now traded and has been one of the most stable cryptocurrencies out there. There's all sorts of bizarre concepts, and it's going to become to the point where, for example, if somebody wants to launch some sort of community organization around, you know, whatever, let's do this environmental project or whatever it is, they issue their own coin and people will adopt that coin or not adopt that coin, and their adoption and use of that will be their way of participating and validating that there is a demand for it. It's a way of expressing demand, the adoption and use of it.
There's a democratic impulse here. People are voting, essentially. They're not just spending. They are voting not only on the product that they wish to purchase, but they're voting on what currency they want to use to purchase that product. And there are votes here, and what it comes back to, perhaps, is this question of stability. You can have a bunch of people, a new currency can go viral, and it can be extraordinarily popular for 6 months, for a year, or however, and then all of a sudden the public can turn against it and go to the next currency. And how do we maintain stability in this world of cryptocurrencies?
Is stability the goal? That would be another question. I guess the question is, what do we want to facilitate? And stability is an interesting word, because you could look at the last 50 years of monetary paradigm of the world reserve currency of the U.S. dollar and the post-Bretton Woods system being backed by the petrodollar and all of that. It's stable in a sense. I mean, it's existed for decades now, and even if it is a game of musical chairs, at least the music has been playing for the vast majority of the lifespan of the vast majority of people on the planet right now. So there's some aspect of stability to that, but is that the system we want? I would imagine most people, when really confronted with the facts, would say no. So I think the question is, what do we want to facilitate, and what does that mean? And I certainly don't claim to have this all figured out. I don't think anyone does at this point, but we're in the process of discovering that. And I think that some very old ideas and very entrenched ideas about what this monetary system is and how it should work are being upended, and that can be, theoretically, it can be to the good. Like absolutely everything else that exists, it can be co-opted and used for nefarious purposes by oligarchs who want to basically consolidate control. But there is, as you say, there is a democratic urge here. I know that word certainly has its connotations, but I know what you mean by that, that this is a participatory thing in which people get to decide what they use and in what situation and for what purpose, and their attention and their time and their effort becomes an expression of the value of that thing. That's an important concept for getting away from the banker paradigm, where you will all use this piece of paper that we tell you has value, and because we tell you it has value, it will be valued. Which obviously is the underlying tool for authoritarians and tyrants, and has been.
I think it's the idea of the Federal Reserve note, the fiat currency, debt-based monetary system. It laid the foundation for American power after World War II. The petrodollar, particularly starting up 71, 73 in there, in the 70s. Laid the foundation for much of American power. If we go into cryptocurrencies, can we have strong centralized government? I mean, this is not just, the currency is not just a little sideline. This is what government is finally all about. And if we go into a decentralized currency, can we have still have a centralized governmental power, or does it essentially take the government apart? And I think we've got about, 2 minutes left.
Well, this is what the crypto coin evangelists have been saying for several years now, that this is, if you were interested in even just taking away some of the power of the state, let alone getting rid of it entirely, the way to do that is through using these types of cryptocurrencies and not using their fiat currencies. Because obviously the debt-based monetary system is what underlies the U.S. military machine, for example, to do its atrocities around the world. And the U.S. government can continue printing debt till the cows come home to fund that because of the U.S. world reserve dollar paradigm, the petrodollar. And if we can take away that power by stopping, to the extent possible, the use of their fiat currencies, their debt-based monetary paradigm, then we take that leg out from under them. And I think that has to be part of the solution moving forward from here. Whether that is actually the way this will play out is a completely different matter, but I think that has to be part of the underlying philosophy of this.
Well, one last thing there. We've got probably about 40 seconds left, and I've got an article from Prophecy News Watch, and the headline is "The Growing Jewish Divide on Israel." And they have a picture here where they have, Jews, right? They have the hat, the beard, the rest, that sort of thing. Orthodox Jews carrying signs, "Judaism respects the Zionist state." Is there a significant division going on in Israel right now, or is this just a sideline? And you have about 10 seconds. Yes, maybe so.
There's always been a divide. I don't know if that is increasing or decreasing, but there has always been a faction that's against the Zionist state, but I don't know if it's a large majority.
All right. Well, thanks very much, James. Always a pleasure to have you on the program. Intelligent conversation and good insight, and we appreciate it. Look forward to talking to you in about 2 weeks. In the meantime, hope you folks enjoyed the program. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back tomorrow. In the meantime, good Lord bless you, me, Melody, James, Todd, the producer. Bye-bye.